Chapter 3, 1 Timothy chapter 3, in your Bible this morning, and that's where we will begin our study together, 1 Timothy chapter 3. Glad to see you this morning, glad that you're here. It's good to be worshiping God together. This is, after all, the highest thing we can do in life. Worship Him, serve Him, bring Him glory. This is why we were created, this is why we're here. And it's good to share in that reality together this morning. If you're visiting with us, thank you. Welcome. We hope that if it's your first time, it won't be your last, that you'll avail yourself of a visitor's packet at one of the three exits to the auditorium if you haven't already received one, and that you'll use that visitor's packet. You'll read the material in it about the Bible, about this congregation, about what's going on here, that you'll use that visitor's card and share a little bit of yourself, any spiritual needs, concerns, or questions that you might have. We'd love to hear from you about that. We're glad that you are here this morning. I want to start this morning with the commercial. The commercial is for Young Adults Weekend, which will be 2 weeks from this weekend. We've been announcing the dates for a while, the weekend of Saturday, May 14th, and Sunday, May 15th. But I wanted to give you a little bit more detail about that. There are flyers of it, of this slide, available in the foyer. I think some of you may have already received one of these in class even this morning. But certainly for our young adults, this is our young adults weekend. Typically we define young adults as 35-ish. I take that number personally. 35-ish is young adults and under. And basically college age of 35-ish or so. But we're not going to turn anybody away. We're not going to check hairlines or gray hairs or anything like that. If you want to come and worship with us and listen to Brother Jennings' lessons, yes, you're more than welcome to do that. But nonetheless, we'll be doing Saturday morning, a couple of sessions Saturday morning. Young adults will, in room 17 on Sunday morning, have their own Bible class session with Tim. And then Tim will be speaking to us in the worship hour that Sunday morning. Spiritual priorities for young adults. We live in a world in which not only does the world try to crowd out that which is good and godly, but frankly, I think one of the challenges for all of us is that it's not just a matter of evil crowding out the good. There are so many legitimate and worthwhile things we can be doing with our time. How do you make the hard choices? How do you prioritize what you're going to do with the limited resources you have, whether it's your time, your money, whatever it may be? How do we choose among the good things, the good opportunities even available to us? A lot to think about when it comes to the prioritizing our spiritual lives. And so as young adults, we're going to be talking about that on that Thursday and Friday. And we hope that we'll see as many of you as possible. All right. Hopefully you found 1 Timothy chapter 3 by now. This morning we start getting a little bit more concrete. Curtis has been working with us the past couple of Sundays, talking with us about the relationship between elders and the congregation, the role of elders in the congregation, the duties and responsibilities of the congregation back to elders. This morning, we move into the next stage of our congregational discussion and conversation about eldership, where we begin to now talk a little bit more concretely about what qualifies a man to serve as a shepherd, as a bishop, as a pastor, as an overseer, as an elder. Pick whichever biblical term you want, but what qualifies a man to serve a congregation in this capacity? Given that, especially this Sunday, we are moving into more concretely now talking about the type of man that we are looking for in this process, the elders have asked me to make you aware, to remind you really, something they mentioned a couple of weeks ago when we first started this process. Today is May 1st, and accordingly, at all three exits to the auditorium, you will find one of these sheets this morning. And on this sheet are the passages from Timothy and Titus that we're going to be talking about this morning and next week, in which the Bible details the scriptural qualifications for a man to serve as an overseer per God's will. And on that sheet, besides those passages, are places for you to write the names of men that you believe are qualified to serve this congregation as overseers going forward. Now, what's crucial is, on this sheet, besides this place to write names of men you believe are qualified, is this statement that the elders are asking you to sign. I have personally approached each of these men to determine if they aspire to serve as an elder, and I believe they are qualified to do so. And so again, nobody wants to be surprised when their name gets read from the pulpit potentially in a few weeks because they didn't even know anybody was thinking of them that way. No, that would be bad. Kind of reminds me of the time a few years ago we were doing this in a congregation I was preaching at in the time. And I had taught for a number of weeks on qualifications for elders. And it came time to give names, and this sweet lady, older lady, came up and she asked me, you know, keep in mind, I'm in my late 20s at this point, don't even have any kids yet, and she asked me, Jeff, would you mind if I put your name forward? And I was a little bit flattered. I also felt a little bit like a failure. And I told her, thank you very much for the consideration, but I'd really rather she not. That's the way it's supposed to work. Don't surprise anybody. Talk to them. At least she asked. I would have been really surprised if... No, that... But that's the point. That's the sheet. Also be aware of the deadline that is on the sheet. May 15th. Basically 2 weeks from today. There's a box that's in the back foyer here. And the elders want all names submitted. All sheets submitted. If you're going to submit it, you've got till May 15th. To get that taken care of. So the next 2 weeks, as we're talking about the explicit scriptural qualifications of elders, now is the time for you to begin thinking about the men you believe are qualified, meet these qualifications to serve this congregation in that way, and it's the time to begin approaching them and asking them if they have the desire and if they are willing to serve the congregation. All right. The qualifications for elders can be summed up in one sense in the word maturity. Oh, there's a lot of other words we could use for it, to be sure. But the word maturity is a good one to, at least if we're looking for big picture concepts. What's the type of man that we're looking for? Maturity is a good word to start with. The type of men who have been described by God's inspiration through the Apostle Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 3, where I've asked you to turn this morning, and Titus chapter 1, these men who meet these qualifications, who have these attributes, who have had these life experiences that these passages describe, are those who ultimately have, through long experience and committed attention, well developed the character of mind and the habits of daily life that demonstrate mature Christ-likeness. Well, I want you to understand something this morning as well as we begin our more detailed conversation and study together about what the Bible actually says qualifies a man to serve in this way. Make no mistake about it. It doesn't just need for this process to work. It doesn't just need qualified men. It also needs a mature congregation. It takes maturity on the part of a congregation to identify within itself truly qualified men, qualified by God's own revealed standards, and to then appoint them and submit to them with love and peace characterizing the entire process. You need mature men to appoint elders, but you need a mature congregation to do this rightly and to do this well also. I've asked you to open the 1 Timothy chapter 3, and by asking you to open there, you might be thinking that where we want to start reading is in verse 1, but you'd be wrong. I want to start with you this morning in verse 14 of 1 Timothy chapter 3, where the Apostle Paul lays out why he has provided this book to Timothy in the first place. And he says this, beginning in verse 14. He says to Timothy, I am writing these things to you, hoping to come to you before long, but in case I am delayed, I write so that you will know how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support of the truth. Basically, what Paul tells Timothy is this. Listen, Timothy, you're a young man. I know that. I'm an apostle. I'm inspired. I've been put into this position by God. I may not get there in time. He has left him in the city of Ephesus, we read at the very, very beginning of the letter. Timothy is in Ephesus. And Paul tells Timothy, listen, Timothy, I'm sending you this letter in case I don't make it to Ephesus when I want to, when I hope to get there, because I want you to know what right behavior in the church of God, the local congregation of God, looks like. And if you go back and you look at the larger context of this first letter of Paul to Timothy in the first place, the overall context of Timothy, what's going on? Whether in the beginning of chapter 1, where he talks about the false teachers that are at work in the congregation, to whether he comes to chapter 2, in the beginning of chapter 2, when he talks about the role of congregational prayer, whether the second half of chapter 2, where he talks about the limitations on women. They are not to be public speakers or teachers in the congregation. To chapter 3, where he describes then the qualifications of elders, to the qualifications of deacons, to literally when he comes to verse 14, which is the end of that first half of the book, basically he says, is everything I'm doing here, Timothy, everything I'm doing, from telling you about what to pray for in the congregation, to reminding women to be silent, to here's the kinds of leaders that you're looking for, everything I'm doing here is so that people will know, you included, that y'all will know how to rightly live together in the relationship of the local congregation. And that basically becomes the large context of which Paul's qualification lists to Timothy exists. That basically what Paul is saying to Timothy is part of what it means to get your local congregational life right. It means praying in the right way. It means women knowing their place in the congregation. It means that we get the right kind of leadership in place. Elders as the shepherds and spiritual leaders of the congregation. Deacons as the servants who minister to the material needs and works of the congregation. But that's a crucial part of what it means to do church right. Which is why I said what I said at the very beginning this morning. You need qualified men, but you need a mature congregation to do this rightly and to do this well also. Indeed, one of the things I want you to take away from our time together this morning is the significance of the larger context in which not just the qualification list that Paul gives to Timothy, but also the elder qualification list that Paul gives to Titus in Titus chapter 1, I want you to be more aware, more conscious of the context that both of these lists sit in. Because let's be honest, what most of us have done for probably most of our lives and most of our experience with the appointment of elders and local congregations wherever we've been in the past, is we usually just throw these passages out there and we make lists out of them and we just kind of run through them. And yes, a man meets this or doesn't meet that, but we never get to the larger ideas behind why God says, these are the men I want to lead my local churches. And so part of what we're going to do this morning, in the first week of our conversation and study about the qualifications of elders, is to put those lists back into their context that they sit in these books. And to do that, I want you to notice, in both the letter to Timothy and the letter to Titus, we've already seen how Paul in chapter 3 explicitly says, I'm writing this to you so basically y'all can do church right. You can get the local congregation right. But here's what he says to both of these young men at the beginning of their letters. 1 Timothy chapter 1, beginning of verse 3. He says to Timothy, as I urged you upon my departure from Macedonia, remain on at Ephesus, where Timothy was, so that you may instruct certain men not to teach strange doctrines. The first thing that Paul says straight out of the gate to Timothy, part of what it means to do church right, part of what it means to conduct oneself rightly in the household of God, is to deal with those in that congregation who were speaking untrue things, who were teaching contrary to God's revealed will. By the same token, in Titus chapter 1, beginning of verse 5, Paul says this to Titus. He says, this is the reason I left you in Crete, that you would set in order what remains and appoint elders in every city as I directed you. And so Paul to Titus says more specifically that basically what I want you to do is I want you to basically help congregations become mature. I want you to help them basically become what God wants them to be, scripturally organized with elders. That's why I left you in Crete. So both these preachers are tasked by the Apostle Paul with helping congregations achieve the right relationship within themselves as households of God, as a manifestation, the local manifestation of God's household. In Timothy's case, as explicitly mentioned at the beginning, part of what that means is overcoming the false teachers that are at work in Ephesus. Even though Paul starts more generically with Titus and just says simply, set in order what remains to be done, by the end of his qualification list for elders, because that's the first thing then straight out of the gate that Paul talks to Titus about, beginning then in verse 6, By verse 9, the very last thing that Paul says in his description there to Titus of the qualifications of elders, is that the elder must hold fast the faithful word, which is in accordance with the teaching, so that he will be able both to exhort in sound doctrine and to refute those who contradict. And then guess what Paul does in verse 10? He goes on to describe the problem of false teaching in Crete. In other words, in the larger context of both qualification lists and both letters that Paul originally wrote to Timothy and to Titus, in both cases, both of these men were tasked with helping congregations achieve the right structure and organization, but they were also tasked with helping those congregations deal with the false teaching, the unscriptural and ungodly ideas that some among them were apparently teaching and some of them were apparently listening to. And what you begin to realize is that it is part of what God is doing. Part of God's answer to false teaching, false ideas, spiritual immaturity, spiritual deception, is the work of elders, of overseers in a local congregation. I want you to think about it. Maybe you've never thought about it this way before, but I want you to think about it this way this morning. Have you ever noticed that the only two times in the entire New Testament that the detailed descriptions of the qualities of overseers are given at any length whatsoever are in two letters written about the same time to two co-workers of Paul who have been in two different places to do the same basic work? Organize local congregations according to God's pattern and stop the false teaching that was not really just in false ideas, but teaching that was also false because of the depraved character of those who were doing the teaching. And they were to deal with that. They were to counter that. Oh, Paul and Titus were to personally counter that, but part of why God emphasizes the qualities he emphasizes for overseers is that a large part of the elder's work at the end of the day is to teach and to rebuke. Part of the means by which God intended not just for a congregation to be scripturally organized, somebody's got to be in charge here. One of the reasons that God asked these types of men to serve congregations in these types of capacities is because the crucial work of teaching the truth and rebuking, whether it's misunderstanding through ignorance or honest error, or whether it's false teaching rooted in a depraved character, those who, for instance, as Paul talks about elsewhere, are greedy for sordid gain. Whatever the reason, whether it's honest mistake or greediness or depraved character, whatever the reason, part of God's answer was not just send Titus and Timothy in there to be the lone ranger and solve the problem. Part of God's long-term solution to spiritual immaturity and untruth was a class of men known as the overseers or the elders who would teach the congregation and rebuke those who were straying. And so when we begin to see these qualification lists in context, we begin to realize how crucial the role of elders is among God's people. How the appointment of elders was God's solution to the ever-present problem in every local congregation of rightly reading and studying and applying and teaching and confessing divine truth and countering those who stray from it. In a very real sense, as we begin to comb through these lists and look at these qualifications, what you begin to see in a lot of ways is that in a very real sense, the men that we are looking for are men who are simply living the Christian life that is called of everyone. But they are more experienced, they are wiser, and they are more mature than the rest of us. They've had the experience of a long and successful marriage and raising healthy and spiritual children. They are people who have had the long experience of cultivating wisdom and discretion. They've learned to control their tempers. They've learned to say no to the materialism of the world. And they are to be our shepherds. They are to be our teachers in how to do the same and rebuke those who fail to do the same. They, in a sense, are living the Christian life call of everyone, but they are more experienced, they are wiser, they are more mature. Because listen, Yes, God tells the elders to not be addicted to wine, but who among us should be? Yes, the elders are called to be not argumentative and to be gentle, but who among us is that not true of? Now, I'll grant that a couple of the things in these lists, as you read in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and Titus chapter 1, like being married or having children, that's not required of every Christian to be right with God. But I will tell you this, as other passages in the Bible make clear, if you do have a wife, men, if you do have children, fathers, and you don't raise them to nurture the admonition of the Lord, and if you don't dwell with your wife according to understanding and knowledge, as Peter warns husbands of 1 Peter, there are consequences for that. And so in a very real sense, men are to aspire to this office. Oh yes, to be sure. They are aspire to serve the congregation in this way. But part of what we're looking for is just simply people who have walked the path further than we have, done it the way we need to, and who can therefore give us wise guidance and counsel, who can teach us and correct us. And so Paul tells Timothy, I've written to you so you'll know how to do church right, so you can do the local congregation right. Titus, I've left you behind to help local congregations find these type of men, because these type of men are the ones that we need to teach us and to correct us when we are wrong. And it is amazing how thoroughly, in the larger context of these books, these lists remind us, these lists are even a contrast with those who are otherwise at work in the congregation who need to be rebuked. The first thing in both lists, in Titus chapter 3 and verse 2, First Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2, as well as Titus chapter 1 and verse 6, the first thing that's mentioned in both lists is that an overseer has to be the husband of one wife. We'll talk more specifically about what that means next week, but you can't help but notice that one of the very next things that Paul takes up in 1 Timothy chapter 4, the very next chapter, is this, that what's going to happen according to the Spirit in the last days is some are going to fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits, doctrines of demons. They are going to be, verse 3, men who forbid marriage. In other words, part of what God even recognized that he is doing and saying, these are the type of men who are spiritual leaders. These are the type of men I want. These need to be men who have the experience of successful marriage. They are the husbands of one wife. It's a reminder that even though sometimes some in the world who claim religious insight or religious knowledge or some greater wisdom will do things like even deny the validity of marriage, the goodness of marriage, some who will teach it's more spiritual to forego marriage, inherently more spiritual to forego marriage. Even in the larger context of Timothy, we see how the type of men God is looking for to shepherd his church are in direct contrast to the false doctrines that some will propagate. The time that we have together this morning, particularly as we think a little bit more about the larger context of these letters that these lists sit in, I want to make four observations very quickly. Next week, we will dig into the lists in particular. There are sheets in the back of the auditorium. Besides the sheets for men's names that the elders have left for you this morning, there's a sheet that I have left as well, as just as Curtis has been leaving sheets on the lessons the past couple weeks. There are some thought questions. The two key passages from 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 are there. Read them this week. Study them. Meditate upon them. Come back next week. We will talk in much greater detail about the specific things in those lists. But because part of rightly applying those specific things in those lists is rightly understanding the place that these lists sit in these books, what they remind us about the basic work of overseers as those who teach and those who rebuke, is that I want to notice four crucial ideas that come from the context and from what Timothy is doing and what Paul is doing to Timothy and to Titus. I want to look and think about four specific things that the larger context reminds us about when it comes to the nature of elders and who they are and how they serve us. That's what we'll do together in the few minutes that we have left this morning. And then next week, we'll talk very specifically about those lists themselves. Number one, what I want you to notice, qualifications and context. Number one is that what these lists remind us is that what we are looking for is character and true ability. We are looking for men of true character, substantive spirituality, and true ability. Their job is going to be to rebuke, to correct, to admonish. And one of the things that Paul makes very clear is the reason that we look at an elder's household, he tells Timothy, is because if a man doesn't know how to handle his own house, he won't be able to handle God's own household. We're looking for men who have proven ability to do this type of work. I'll say more about that specific qualification next week, but just recognize from the very beginning, we're looking for character and we're looking for true ability. Because what's interesting is when you go back and you look at the false teaching that Paul is concerned about for both Timothy and Titus's original context, in both of those cases, it's not just what was specifically being said that was wrong, it was the character of the men who were doing or saying these things that was a problem as well. And so, for instance, whether it's Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 6 later on saying in verse 3, if anyone advocates a different doctrine and does not agree with sound words, those of our Lord Jesus Christ, and with a doctrine conforming to godliness, he's conceited, he understands nothing. He's got a morbid interest in controversial questions and disputes about words. That's why an elder's got to be gentle and able to correct people without losing control. Because the false teachers, they like argument, controversial questions, disputes about words, out of which arise envy, strife, abusive language, evil suspicions. The ability of the elders to do this type of work without arousing those kind of passions is one of the crucial things that qualifies them for it. They're in direct contrast to the false teachers that Paul is worried about and concerned about. But here's the thing too. He says in verse 5 of 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 5, and they are men of constant friction between men, of depraved mind and deprived of truth. It's not just that what they're saying is wrong, it's that they themselves are depraved. They believe that godliness is a means of gain, which, by the way, puts all the more in a stark relief than when Paul says of elders in chapter 3, they need to be mean and not greedy for sordid gain. Because in a very real sense, what Paul is doing in this list is saying, listen, you see not just the false ideas that these men are teaching in the congregation, but do you see their very character itself? The true spiritual leader of a congregation is a man who knows the truth of Jesus and is a man whose character reflects it. He's not in religion for the money. He's not serving to accumulate power to himself. The qualifications, larger context, are about the character of the man and his true ability. Listen, all these false teachers can do is cause skirmishes. The discussions that they lead end up in envy, strife, and abusive language. But the elder is to be temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, and able to teach. He's got to be able to do this without allowing these situations to develop. The elder is to be a man of character and true ability. Here's the thing, ladies and gentlemen. Here's the thing. We too often fail to use God's values and to use God's vision and how we appraise other people. Remember the story of how God anoints King David? Remember that story? I love that story, don't you? 1 Samuel chapter 16. Remember that story? Samuel the prophet is sent by God to the household of Jesse to anoint the next king because Saul has failed God for the final time and God is ready to move on. And even Samuel, prophet of God that he is, even Samuel falls into this trap of using the world's values and the world's ways of judging people because you remember, the text says when they enter, there's the sons of Jesse enter the picture. Samuel looks at Eliab, Jesse's oldest, and thinks, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. Look at that guy. But isn't that part of the problem? Think about it. When Saul was anointed king of Israel, the description of him, was there any description of his spiritual qualities or was it just his physical attributes? It was just how tall he was. He was head and shoulders above everybody else. Nothing about his heart. How'd that turn out? It was a disaster. And as though Samuel himself apparently hasn't even learned the lesson yet, God says to Samuel, listen, Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at his height. Haven't we been down this road already? Because I've rejected him. For God sees not as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And so they paraded all of Jesse's other children by. The Lord chooses none of them. Is anybody left? Samuel asked. Jesse says, yes, the runt of the litter. No, that's not what you literally called him. But that was basically the point. David, the youngest, he's out with the sheep. And they brought him in. And God said to Samuel, arise and anoint him because this is he. Ladies and gentlemen, you and I have to learn to use God's values and God's vision and how we appraise other people. Israel's experience should be a warning to us. First comes King Saul. He looked right for the job. We want a king like all the nations, somebody who will go out and fight our battles for us. Well, if that's what you want, you need a big man, and Saul was a big man. But the irony is, head and shoulders above everybody else, though he was, in other words, giant though he was among his peers, he wouldn't even go out and fight another giant when the Philistines produced theirs. It took David the runt, the little guy, the young guy, to go out and do the king's work. We're not so different. We think we're above that, but we're not so different. You know what's interesting? You can go on Wikipedia. You can actually see this. It's kind of cool. It's kind of fun. You can actually go on Wikipedia and see this. And it's a chart of all the presidential elections in the history of this country based upon height. And you know what's really interesting? You see that the trend becomes crystal clear. There's a couple of exceptions. George W. Bush is actually one of the biggest recent exceptions. He was shorter than both Al Gore and John Kerry. Way shorter than John Kerry. Excepting George W. Bush, if you look at this chart on Wikipedia, it's absolutely fascinating. Basically, for most of the 20th century, a couple of exceptions, but for most of the 20th century, guess who wins the election? The taller candidate every time. What changed in the 20th century? We became a visual culture, ladies and gentlemen. First, there were the newspapers with their pictures. Think about it. You might have, in the previous century, you might have voted for a man you didn't even know what he looked like. But with the rise of the 20th century, mass media, first the newspapers and their pictures, and then later at mid-century, television, and the rise of debates and everything else. The taller candidate wins nearly every time. Oh, don't tell me we're so different than Israel, ladies and gentlemen. In fact, we could save a lot of money, a lot of time, if next time just both parties pick their candidates. We'll just get a tape measure out in July. We'll measure them. We'll be done. We'll save a lot of money. No more robocalls. It'll be great. Even Samuel had to be corrected by God about this very human tendency. And so listen, ladies and gentlemen, when it comes to rightly, when we understand what's going on even here in Timothy and Titus, where in both of these books, what Paul is literally doing is saying, that's a spiritual leader and that's not a spiritual leader. These are the men God wants. Don't be taken in by these men who teach untruth and may look wise, but they're really just in it for the money. They may talk a good game and sound smart. They may be able to sound very wise about the law. They want to be teachers of the law, he says back at the beginning of 1 Timothy chapter 1. These false teachers, they may sound good and they may look good and they may be very smooth, but listen, you've got to look at people the way God looks at people, and these are the men who are going to be your teachers and your shepherds. These are the men who will rebuke you. These are the men who will help you get to God's eternal city. And I'll tell you, if our modern presidential elections or any indication, we, ladies and gentlemen, are still very subject to the power of appearances. When it comes time to seriously consider men for this crucial role in the congregation, listen, it is not a popularity contest. It is not about picking people we are friends with or people that we're comfortable with in a social way and we think that they're nice people and they're older men and I don't know that there's anything particularly wrong with them. And so you know what? I'll just put his name down. It's not a popularity contest, ladies and gentlemen. It's not about earthly success. It's not about the men who seem smartest or wisest according to this world. It's not about people who have impressive educational accomplishments or powerful job titles or famous reputation. Listen, it's not about how long somebody's been here at Kleinwood even. It's not like tenure at a college or a university. It's not, I've been here so many years and now it's my turn to get some acknowledgement or recognition. It's not, I've served my time or paid my dues and now I'm owed this position by virtue of my long tenure in this congregation. This, ladies and gentlemen, this is not an honorary position or a reward for long-time membership. This is not one of those things where you stay here 3 years to get your own pew, you stay here five a parking space, 15 will make you elder. You and I, ladies and gentlemen, need to be very careful as members of this congregation at this time to examine our hearts, to check our biases, to reject the tendency to partiality, to purify our motives, and to sanctify our understanding of God's will on this matter. That what we are looking for is men of character and true ability to do this work. Because literally what Paul is doing with Timothy, especially in 1 Timothy, is saying, not them, but these men. This is what you're looking for. And make no mistake about it, ladies and gentlemen, we as a congregation will be accountable to God for our failure to not just take God's qualifications, but for our failure to truly, correctly, honestly, spiritually apply them, to look for true character and true ability. Listen, just a page over in 1 Timothy chapter 5, listen to the warning that Paul gives to Timothy that I think still very much applies to us. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, he begins the paragraph in verse 19 or so by talking to Timothy about not receiving any random accusation against elders. You've got to have two or three witnesses to substantiate an accusation of sin against an elder. But here's the thing. He says in this context of what happens if an elder is caught in sin? What happens, the implication almost is, what happens if there are two or three witnesses? What happens if it is true? Listen to what he does, starting in verse 21. Hear that language? This is serious business, ladies and gentlemen. I solemnly charge you in the presence of God and of Christ Jesus and of his chosen angels to maintain these principles without bias, doing nothing in a spirit of partiality. Now, he's talking concretely there about disciplining elders if the situation arises. But the bottom line is, when we're handling elders, there's to be no partiality. There's to be no bias. We're using God's standards and God's way. But listen to what he goes on to say, the very next thing in verse 22. Do not lay hands upon anyone too hastily and thereby share responsibility for the sins of others. Keep yourself free from sin. Here's what he's saying in the context, ladies and gentlemen. If you carelessly, Timothy, or too quickly are involved in importing unqualified men to this role of overseer, and later two or three witnesses come forward and a charge of grievous and unrepentant sin is substantiated against that elder. Listen, it's one thing if that nobody saw it coming, we did the best we could, we made an honest appraisal, we thought we had picked an honorable man. It's another thing entirely if you were too quick and too hasty and too careless, and a man who should never have been an elder in the first place is now guilty of some specific sin. You, in a sense, then share in the responsibility for what he has done and the scandal that the congregation has caused. Ladies and gentlemen, this is serious business. Do not lay hands, Timothy, upon anyone too hastily and thereby share the sins of others. You appoint somebody who's not truly qualified and it blows up down the road. Listen, it's not just that man's fault. It's our fault. If unqualified people are appointed, God holds us responsible. It's about character and about true ability. It's not a popularity contest. Number two, it is, as I've already said, it is about maturity. Again, most of these qualifications, many of these qualifications, the attitude, the character attributes, many of these things, they really should be true of all Christians. What we're really looking for is men in particular who have family experience, who are blameless, of good repute, who basically are able to not just live the life themselves, but teach others also, and who have a track record in their own homes of being able to do this. But the bottom line is, what we are looking for, ladies and gentlemen, is we are looking for men who have been there and done that. We are looking for men who understand the temptations that are common to mankind and have met them successfully. We are looking for men who have struggled with temptation and overcome them. We are looking for men who understand what it takes to refuse the mediocrity of spiritual laziness and who have willfully chosen the hard work of continually putting the kingdom of God first in all aspects of their lives. We are looking for men who have said no to what the world offers, who are not greedy for sordid gain. They have chosen to cast their lots in life with the people of God, and the people of God are their first and foremost place of identity. This is where these men most truly belong. When you think of these men, you think of them as a Christian first. Whatever they may do, whatever secular job title they may have, whatever earthly success they may have accomplished, you see in them a Christian before you see a CEO or a successful lawyer or whatever it may be. These are men who have made marriage work for the long term in a world that has destroyed the institution. And these are men who have successfully raised children and have the hard-earned wisdom that comes from that experience. These are not perfect men. Elders even have room to grow. Nobody's perfect. But they are examples of what is spiritually possible for fallen human beings who are committed to the gospel, who have mastered the gospel's content, and who have disciplined their lives to its teaching, who have ordered their homes according to God's principles, and who have fought the good fight and served the cause of God with distinction over the long term. These are not new converts. These are men who remind us and teach us and admonish us and rebuke us, not only with the God-given authority of their role in the congregation, but with the moral authority that comes from living the message that they proclaim. We're looking for men whose very lives are present proclamations that, yes, it is possible to live by God's and Christ's high, holy, ethical standards, even in the midst of a crooked and perverse era. We're looking for mature men who can teach us to do the same. Because the fact of the matter is, ladies and gentlemen, God never intended Christians to go it alone. Whether it's Hebrews 10 and verse 24 in the context of the assembly when the Hebrew writer says, let's consider to stimulate, how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds. To Paul's reminders in his letters to the Corinthians about the power of example for good or for ill. So what the Hebrew writer says in Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 7, he says, remember those who led you, who spoke the word of God to you, and considering the result of their conduct, imitate their faith. Consider and remember those who led you. When you see the result of their lives, imitate their faith. We're looking for mature Christians. Number three. What it's really about is opposing the world. The world ever encroaches on us. So we are looking at men who are not just themselves fighting the good fight and opposing the world, but men who have the courage and the ability to lead us in opposing the world. The world ever encroaches on us. There was so much worldliness that was encroaching in Ephesus or in Crete. I think about Titus chapter 1 where Paul there says to Titus, beginning of verse 10, immediately after his list of qualifications for elders, he reminds Titus that there are many rebellious men, empty talkers, deceivers, especially those of the circumcision, who must be silenced. They're upsetting whole families, teaching things they should not teach for the sake of sordid gain. One of themselves, a prophet of their own, said, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. You know what Paul's doing there? He's saying even the Cretans themselves admit their culture is corrupt. And you know what the problem is, Titus? That culture is getting into these congregations. You've got to stop it, and you need to get these elders to help you with it. Resist and fight back and push back on the worldliness that is all around us. That's what the elders do. Paul in chapter 3 of 1 Timothy, he lays out to Timothy, here's the type of men you are looking for as your spiritual shepherds. And then he immediately begins to say, in chapter 4, because you know what? The Spirit says in the last days, here's the false teachings that are coming. Men who are going to forbid marriage and forbid certain foods which God has created joyfully to be shared in by those who believe and know the truth. And your job, Timothy, is to warn brethren. And the elder's job when you're gone, especially, is to hold the line against the influx of the world. And so that's why Paul, as a concrete example, said to the elders in Acts chapter 20 when he summoned them, be on guard for yourselves in the flock. Because we are looking for men, and the elders' role is to oppose the world, to fight back and push back on the world's desire to overwhelm us. The context of the qualification for elders in Timothy and Titus clearly emphasizes this role. The culture's corrupt, Titus. You and the elders fight it. Get it out of the congregation. And ladies and gentlemen, that's a reminder for us even here and even now that when our elders get up and express from the pulpit some concern about something that's going on in the world, or they approach us maybe individually, they're concerned about some trend, some emerging custom, some fad, some entertainment that everybody's engaging in. Listen, they're not being nosy, and they're not meddling, and they're not taking all the fun out of life, and they're not being out of touch, as we sometimes grumble. They're doing exactly what they're supposed to do by God's own dictate. They are holding the line against the encroachment of the world upon us. They are God's line of defense for the congregation. They are shepherds protecting the sheep. And what this congregation, what every congregation needs is men who are able to hold that line. And number four, very quickly and very finally, one of the often overlooked words that I want to talk about even this week for just a moment is stewardship. In Titus chapter 1 and verse 7, Titus says of overseers that the overseer must be above reproach as God's steward. Stewardship is in many ways a lost concept in our day and our age. Stewards are entrusted with the responsibility of taking care of someone else's things, of guarding someone else's affairs, of protecting someone else's interests. When we hear the word stewardship, a lot of times we think of either maybe a steward in the sense of, somebody who serves food and drink on a train. Or remember the old term, an airline stewardess. It's not politically correct anymore. But the stewardess. Somebody who just brings along some peanuts and a soft drink and just kind of gets you through your flight. We think anything better, bigger than the word steward, we think about almost just a job, an employment situation. Somebody who punches 9 to 5, protects the boss's interest, takes care of the company line, and then goes home. Stewards, biblically speaking, are much more than just somebody who's an employee who does a little bit of hospitality and takes care of things during their shift. Our modern employer-employee dynamic is absolutely inadequate as a point of reference, because overseers are not called to be managers as such. To be a steward means there's no downtime, there's no off time. To be a steward in the Bible is a full-time, total identity issue, because ultimately what you have been entrusted with is so valuable and so important that the bottom line is, no matter how much time you have to invest in, no matter how much you have to suffer or sacrifice, when the master or when the owner returns, you are accountable and saying, listen, I put in my 40 hours a week and they're just, these are the results, sorry. That's not going to cut it. You are completely, when you are biblically speaking, when you are a steward, you are completely and totally responsible for what happens. In other words, to be a steward in the Bible, it's not a job, it's a lifestyle. And with stewardship comes both authority, because the master has put you in charge of his goods or his affairs, and accountability back to that master. In the Bible, when somebody was appointed a steward of the master's affairs, everybody else in the household was accountable to that steward. And ultimately, that steward was accountable to the master himself. And if something went awry while the master was gone, the master wouldn't be upset with the lower level students, so they might get their punishment if they needed it. But the bottom line is where the master would start is with the steward. I left you in charge. Why and how did this happen? And you may try to pawn it off on your subordinates, but listen, that's not going to cut it. Because you were the steward. With stewardship comes both authority and accountability. And the overseers are God's stewards. Remember even in 1 Timothy 3, the passage we started with this morning, the church is what? God's household. The elders are God's stewards. They are God's household managers. They are the ones who control and run the household of God. They answer to God, and we, our job, ladies and gentlemen, is to listen to them. When they rebuke us, they do it because it's right. But we need to recognize their right to do it as stewards of God's household. They are literally, ladies and gentlemen, they are literally on the line with the Almighty on our behalf. What we are looking for is men who can truly be defined by the work of stewardship in the household of God. That's a word we don't use very much anymore. And to be honest, a lot of times, most of us, probably myself included, our previous experiences with looking for elders and appointing elders, we get so bogged down in the specifics of these lists, we miss some of the big picture concepts, and this is a biggie. We are looking for men who can competently manage the affairs of God's household, and then we submit to their authority as God's stewards. Whatever else overseers, whatever else elders are in life, whatever career they have, whatever they accomplish, whatever reputation for accomplishment they build in their life and their career, the bottom line is the single defining aspect of their life when all is said and done is that they were an elder in the church of God, that they were a steward in God's household, and that they did that job well. We need men who will step up to the plate and make the kind of sacrifice it takes to be God's steward. It's not a job, it's a lifestyle. We're thankful for the men who've already accepted that challenge. We look forward to finding more men among us who are both qualified and willing to be stewards of God's household. But understand this very well, that being a steward has to be of God's house has to be the defining aspect of life. Oh, you'll need to do something to pay your bills, perhaps. You'll have other responsibilities, aged parents, getting kids through college, whatever it may be. But you are a steward of God's house. And literally what's going on in the context of these letters originally? There's the danger of worldliness, there's the danger of false teaching within, and God's looking for stewards who will maintain the integrity of his house against those who would destroy it from within and those who would destroy it from without. Those are the men that we seek as a congregation. And there are some among us who need to be examining themselves even now and mentally preparing themselves to accept such an amazing responsibility. Next week, we'll talk a lot more detail about those lists themselves. Again, this week is the week for reading them. Use the questions and the thought questions and the reminder of the passage themselves on the sheets that are available in the back to study yourself this week about that. Before we're through this morning, though, we want to offer the Lord's invitation to anybody who may need to get their life right with God. If you're here this morning and you need to become a child of God, a Christian, by confessing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, repenting of your sins and being baptized for the forgiveness of those sins, we want to help you with that. We will do that with you this morning. You're here this morning, you're a child of God already, but you are out of step with the Almighty. You have fallen away. The testimony of Scripture, the pleas of your brethren, the rebuke of the elders has fallen on deaf ears until now. But your heart is convicting you and you can stand it no longer. You want to be right with your God and with your brethren. Pray to God for forgiveness of however you fail them. If we can pray with you and for you and be of any spiritual service, share your need with us right now while we